Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. This is my show. Thank you. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the show. Some of you have been anticipating this show, this particular episode of this show. Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth will be on in a bit. Her book is out. Girl in a Band, it's called, available now in all book forms and all book shapes. Look, I just got back from New York City, and I've got to chill out. I've got to chill out. I've not taken it easy since I got done shooting. I was in Rochester, as you know. Those were great shows. Then I went right to New York because I had some meetings to do. Had some people to see. And I apparently had some food to eat. Apparently, it's weird. My brain just starts knocking off things that I got to do. I immediately went to Veselka upon arriving and had a bowl of borscht and four pierogies. And then later that night, I went there with Adam Goldberg. I don't want to drop names, but we were hanging out. So Adam Goldberg and I go back to Veselka. I eat a bowl of borscht again. I eat four pierogies again. I eat kasha. So Adam Goldberg, he's on this meerkat thing. And he starts shooting this thing. He's got to shoot a thing that he said he was going to shoot for himself. And then it ended up he shooting me and then me shooting him. And it was 3.5 hours of us on that phone doing some live streaming thing for like 300 people. And it got pretty ugly. I don't even know if you can still watch it. We had a nice dinner. We had a nice walk. We had a lot of laughs. We were having a good time. We went to the bar at the Bowery. Ran into some horrible women. And a guy with a puppet. You know how you can tell when some people talk that they're just nasty, fucked up people inside? Where like, you know, whatever they're hiding or however, you know, their tone. And this was like, these women were in TV. One was a publicist and one was a producer for news type shows. And they were completely snotty and condescending. Didn't really have any idea who I was. And which is fine, no problem. Most people don't know who I am. But then, you know, the guy that they were with who had a puppet, that's why I pulled him over there. Me and Adam were doing this dumb thing where we were streaming, and I saw a guy in the bar with two women, and he had a puppet. So I had him bring the puppet over because I thought, like, this is funny and spontaneous. That guy's got a puppet. Maybe he'll come over. So the three of them come over. The guy's got no chops. He's got no puppet act. You know, he's just a guy with a puppet. He kept saying, this is Larry the Tranny or something. I kept saying, you know, tranny's not a nice word to use. It's a slang. It's derogatory, and it hurts their feelings. And the woman's like, sounds like, you know, what are you, NPR? What are you, politically correct? And I'm like, what are you, some sort of latent conservative bitch? Like, you know, I said that out loud, and it was not good because, you know, bitch in itself is a slang and derogatory. But it just struck me, the condescension, the assumption. Yeah, like politically correct. It's just, you know, be nice. If something is defined and known to marginalize and hurt someone's feelings, and, you know, you'd be aware of it. I wasn't even saying it. I was telling the guy, you know, maybe you should not do that. But then it's just like there's this tension. I just saw the seething, weird, control freak anger. Just the condescending and, the, you know, just spit it out. Don't dance around it with all sorts of weird rage in your throat and guts that comes pounding through your face, through your dumb eyeballs, and in the slight lilt, you know, in your voice of who you are. Sort of your entire being is some sort of knot of concealment until it comes out like, gah, just like, bleh. I've been lashing out a little. So I got to get some rest, got to get some clarity, got to get some focus, got to get some sober-minded shit going on. Been lashing out on Twitter. I've had a beef with a local pizza place over bullshit. Look, man, I like certain kind of pizza, and I'm on Twitter, and I'm hung up on the crust. I go to New York, I get beautiful pizza at Joe's Pizza. I hold it in my hand, like you fold it over, like a beautiful piece of New York sliced pizza, where you can just fold it right in half before you even take a bite, and the whole thing just is sturdy and beautiful, like a perfect piece of pizza, perfect slice. Fold that shit in half, and it doesn't fall the fuck apart and droop and slop and everything else. That's the way I like it. I'm crust obsessed. But I don't need to tweet that picture to my local pizza place. I don't need to do that. I don't need to attack my fellow comics in roast wars that turn personal. I don't need to do it anymore. I'm done with it. But I had a pretty nice time in New York because the weather was nice. So I'm walking down the street in New York. Some guy just comes up to me and he takes his headphones off and he's standing there and he's like, "Hey man, Mark Maron, I've listened since the beginning. I'm a huge fan. It's so great to meet you. Very earnest guy. I believe his name was Jay. May have been Jason, but maybe Jay. And I'm like, "How you doing, man?" He's like, "Great. I'm just can't believe I'm meeting you. I just want to tell you, I'm just so happy for your success and that you're doing so well. And you know, I've followed you since the beginning. And it's just great. Just keep going, man. It's just so great to witness the whole process." And I'm like, "Well, thank you." And he says, "Where are you going?" I'm like, "Oh, I'm going over to this publishing house." It's like, "Great. That's great." You know, and he says he's so happy for me. And I'm like, "Well, you know, I'm just trying not to fuck it up." And he goes, you will, you're going to fuck it up. And I'm like, "Am I?" He's like, "Oh, definitely, you're gonna fuck it up. But the great thing is we'll all be there with you when you fuck it up. And it'll be great. And I'm like, I don't know if that's true. But I like that he didn't change his tone. And there was the same type of confidence and excitement over him in his mind, knowing that I will definitely fuck it up somehow, but it's gonna be great because we're all gonna be hanging out and moving through that together. I can't completely say he's wrong, but I feel all right. You know what I'm saying? So look, I got Kim Gordon. I don't usually do this, but I did read most of her book, and I went back and listened to many Sonic Youth records, some I'd never heard before. And I just wanted to be prepared, you know, for a lot of reasons, because, you know, I don't know that she's necessarily an easy interview. The woman I'm dating is a huge fan of hers, and Kim took her picture with her, and I think it was like one of the highlights of her life. But let's listen now to my talk with Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth. Her book is Girl in a Band, and it's out now. So,
what was it? You have a lot of guitars there.
I have a few. I don't know if I'm amateur, but I don't play with anybody. That was a gift. That's one of those Jay Maskus Squires.
I recognize that. I have one of those too.
You do? But Jay probably gave you yours.
Yeah. For my birthday.
He's been here. He was here.
I know. I heard his interview. I was impressed. It was impressive.
Tough, right?
You did a good job.
It took a while.
I was awesome.
It wasn't until he started talking about his dad and skiing and stuff.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it was like, oh, thank God.
He's chatty.
He is. Now that I've seen him a couple different places, like now it's okay. Yeah. So what video were you shooting?
It's for this Peaches song called Close Up that I, last year when I was here, last summer, they invited me to come over and lay something down. Which I did.
How'd you get involved with it?
Well, I've known her over the years. Yeah. And then this friend of mine, this kid, Vice Cooler. Well, yeah. I think of him as a kid because I met him when he and his brother when they were 15 and this band XRXBX.
Yeah.
They were touring around as like super young teenagers.
Yeah.
It was a super fast hardcore band. And I've just kind of seen him grow up over the years. And then suddenly he was involved with Peaches, producing her record.
And they want you to be in the video?
Well, they wanted me to. Yeah, once I did the song, then I had to be in the video.
You have to. What was your part in the song?
I hesitate to use the word hook, but when I went in there, it was just kind of like a minimal hip-hop track, and I just put something down, and then Peaches built a rap around it, and they probably added other stuff. And
well, that's cool.
It. Yeah.
It's. I was relieved that you grew up in L.A., because people come up here and they don't know where they are, any sense of what it is. And,
yeah.
And I got through. I read most of your book, which I don't usually do, but I was nervous talk to you. Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know. I just gotten it in my head that I didn't know enough about anything. Not just you. But when I look at, you know, where you come from and what your interests are and the different worlds you were involved in, I was like, I'm not up to speed. So then, like, you know, I'm Googling, you know, Glenn Branca, and I'm seeing him for the first time because of you, because I wanted to do. It was kind of funny. I don't know if ironic's the right word, but I had to sit through a Michelob Ultra commercial before I watched Glenn Branca do some kind of guitar solo.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
I was like, this is exactly what was supposed to not happen. This was the fight.
Right.
But, and then I watched the, when you sang the induction of Nirvana, you sang one of the songs, Aneurysm, right? And I remember watching that when it was on live and like being pretty broken up about it. And then like literally emotionally shattered. And then I watched it again this morning and I cried again.
Oh.
What is that about? What was going on that day?
It was very touching. I mean, it was a very emotional. Actually, the sound check was really difficult because suddenly they had these huge images of Kurt's face up on the screen, and it was a bit, kind of overwhelming. But the whole night of the ceremony was so long and boring.
Yeah.
By the time I got up to sing,
I was chomping at the bit.
Yeah, and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't sad because I just wanted to do something, you know, so active. And I don't know, I was just trying to channel Kurt. I mean, I just, to kind of see Chris and Dave after not seeing them, and Pat and all these other people, like we had shared a lot of the same crew or in common, and manager, and it was like a 90s reunion in a way. But it was such an odd, you know, surreal place to be, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all these kind of elder establishment people.
Enemies, I would imagine, from different points in your life.
Enemies from punk rock.
Like,
yeah.
Having been in the business so long, I have to assume that you walk into a room like that and you're like, oh, there's that fucker.
Oh, well, you know, not in a specific way. Yeah. But, you know, just maybe there were some people I just didn't want to actually talk to who were, you know, would probably like, I don't know, hadn't seen since like the band broke up or Anderson broke up. So there were some people I was avoiding, definitely.
Just out of discomfort?
For that reason. Yeah.
Yeah, it's horrible when you go
that
through.
They kind of want to, you know, give you their sympathy, but then draw it out. You know, they want to draw the sadness into the open.
They can't help it.
And it was such an emotional day anyway, so.
And how fresh was the breakup at that point? Pretty fresh?
I only recently got divorced a couple of months ago.
Horrendous.
But I don't know. It was like a couple years, 2.5 years.
It's horrendous still, though, right?
Yeah. It's an ongoing process that people suddenly think it happens like as soon as they hear you're separated, and then it's over, and then who are you dating?
What
or something.
You, yeah,
you
right,
crazy.
Right. What do you go? How are you bouncing back? It's going to take like 5 years, 10 years.
Yeah.
It's horrendous. I've been divorced twice. It's just the heartbreak is the worst.
Yeah.
It's just like there's nothing you can do to make it go away. I'm sorry. I'm not.
Yeah, no, I mean.
Happy Valentine's Day, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I love that we're having this interview on Valentine's Day. We could discuss dating.
Couple of brokenhearted people.
Dating other people, you know, like experiences.
Yeah. Are you?
Yeah.
Is that right?
I don't know. I think I recently maybe broke up with somebody, or they broke up with me.
Not sure. It's unclear.
Well, yeah, it's unclear. It's not resolved. Like,
we're grown people.
Maybe I'm going to see him today.
Well, good. Well, that's. I'm glad. I'm dating a painter that's like a huge fan of yours, to the point where I was
really?
Like, maybe you should. You know, she should come in here.
Who is it?
Her name is Sarah Kane. She's an abstract painter, and it's and I've just recently been sort of back in that world and trying to understand it, because I feel like I avoided it for so long. I was a comedian, but when I was in college, I was wanted to be an artist, but I didn't have what it took.
Huh?
Yeah, did some photographs.
Yeah,
but in your book, you're very candid about certainly about the breakup, but also about like how the people that kind of built the way you saw the world.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, a lot of men who had a profound influence on how you know, see the world. And starting, I guess, with your brother was the one you really kind of talked about a lot. And did you see him when you come out here?
Yeah, I saw him yesterday.
How was that?
You know, it's always never lasts that long. And it was fine. Like, it's always good to just see him and see that he's doing the same, which is not it's a fine, you know.
he's properly medicated and level.
No, I mean, he was reciting this Dylan song, but he said he wrote it, you know, but he remembers all the words. He has an incredible memory for things like that.
Well, there is sort of like a brilliance to schizophrenia, right?
I think so.
I mean, how did when you guys were growing up, no one really knew that was what was wrong with him? It doesn't kick in.
No, so. It didn't really kick in until like his early 20s, I guess.
That's about the time, right?
Yeah, and you know, I think he was taking a lot of acid and
exacerbated.
There were a lot of people taking a lot of acid.
Right.
It's hard to figure out who was
tripping
on which side of crazy or you know,
right.
Who was eccentric, or he was always an eccentric kid. And
what was your relationship when you were kids?
Well, I looked up to him, and he teased me mercilessly. Like, I mean, every older brother, I'm sure, teases their sister, but I was super sensitive, and he was really overly critical, and it wasn't a good combination.
And you think that because that was a primary relationship, it kind of scarred you for life?
Well, it made me just kind of want to hide my feelings.
Yeah.
Because I cried really easily.
Really?
Yeah. You know, and we had physical fights too. But I mean, when we were teenagers, we were friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, we'd smoke pot together and stuff.
Was he ahead of you in terms of like what he liked? Like, did that have an influence on you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he read, you know, Nietzsche and Sartre and kind of turned me on to all these.
And he got it?
I don't know. I thought he had it, you know. And then, you know, but he was also really into Shakespeare and literature. He wrote poetry. And
so he was like a unique guy.
Yeah.
Is your mom still alive or is it?
No, both my parents are. My mom died in 2002 and my dad in 98.
And your dad was a sociologist?
Yeah, in education at UCLA.
And but like, I see, like, this is the problem with me reading the book, because now I know things.
Yeah.
And I'm going to say it that way. No, but I thought it was kind of interesting. You know, like, I'm sitting here telling you what your story is. But
better you than I have to do it.
Oh, really? Okay, I could just recite it all. Because I know,
I'll just go yes. And
I know a lot about you.
I'm happy.
But I thought it was kind of fascinating that your father was the first to sort of catalog these high school groups.
Well, yeah. I mean, he did a social study.
Yeah.
You know, as his thesis. Yeah, it was squares and socias and
jocks. But there was no stoners
And then my brother was in junior high, he did his own, and it was like surfers and essays. And
but your old man was the guy who figured, like, sort of broke it down, huh?
Yeah,
it was, that's like one of the most important sort of distinguishing things in our lives, is to be able to walk through a high school and go like, those are the stoners, yeah. those are the geeks, those are, and it, like, yeah. it really exists.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably this obvious thing, or yeah. I don't know, like, you know, that sometimes people don't say the obvious.
And, yeah. In your book, though, the one thing I noticed that there's no mention of really learning how to play guitar.
Mm. There's a reason for that.
Really?
Because I didn't. No, you know, I was talking to, actually, I did an interview, Sally Timms from the Mekons interviewed me, and she'd been reading Viv Albertine's book and just talking about how punk rock was this thing that suddenly ignited a whole bunch of activity and sent one in a direction that you wouldn't necessarily have gone.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when I, you know, picked up a guitar or bass, it was definitely way post-punk, but it evolved into or, you know, helped develop what No Wave was and other, you know, just right. downtown kind of underground music. And so the spirit of it was also there, and it was really... It wasn't about learning how to play guitar.
Right. I didn't notice it until after I read most of the book that, like, there usually when you read a musician or a band's book, there's that relationship that's built with an instrument at some point. And it just wasn't, it was like, nope. It just sort of happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I feel stupid that I haven't read Viv's book, but I think she talks about how as girls in punk rock, they had a way different relationship to music and how they learn to play.
Yeah.
I think a lot of boys learn to play in their bedrooms listening to records.
Right. Or from other dudes.
Or from other dudes, yeah.
Show me that thing.
Like, that's a nice lick.
Exactly. Wait, do that again? Hold on. Is that it? A lot of that. But you knew you wanted to be an artist, and now you've come... Have you come back around to visual arts?
Yeah. I mean, since 2003, I've been pretty much...
Painting?
Kind of doing installations or conceptually based painting.
But like, was that the plan from early on? Because I mean, you spend a lot of time, like there's a lot of talk of dance.
Uh-huh. Well, I did also want to be a dancer when I was a teenager, but my mother sort of discouraged that.
Why?
She just said it's a tough life, which is true. It is.
Of any of it.
Yeah. I think dancers have it the hardest.
It's very specific.
Yeah, but I'm also not into anything really conventional, so, like, the music I was drawn to was not conventional music.
But even early on? I mean, you talk like...
The records I listened to growing up was, but I mean, when I went to, as far as when I was in New York and I first saw No Wave bands, I just thought, wow, that's amazing, and I think I can do that.
Right. But when did that start to break
apart? It was so much free.
Yeah. When did that start to break apart, though? Like, I mean, in your mind, like, I know from the book, I just can't even imagine what it was like to grow up in L.A. in the 60s. It must have been amazing.
Yeah, it was. I mean, it was, I guess. It was definitely, you know, less crowded. You know,
Well, to know that many people that might have met Charles Manson, it must have been a much more intimate landscape.
Yeah. I don't know. It was odd. Like, I didn't really like living here, or I wasn't really that. It was this kind of existential nausea of, like, the sun shining the same every day.
Right. But you seem to have found some beauty in it as time went on.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's my favorite place to look at things and visually how... The idea of self-expression, it becomes how you customize everything from your house to your car to...
Right. Hot rod culture, too.
Yeah, and I find, you know, it's all so kind of visually interesting.
And it was sort of fascinating to me that there's these people in your lives that are big people and that a lot of us all know that sort of kind of resurface in your life later.
Right.
I mean, it's very odd to me, but I guess it's really not that odd that Danny Elfman and you went to school together and that you had this relationship, but he's his own thing too.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys got very close when you were in high school?
Yeah.
Do you still talk to him?
I haven't. I mean, I've run into him a couple times.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine plays... volleyball or something in his house once a week.
He's got a game of some kind going on. How did he factor into your whole sort of like the way you saw yourself at that time, or how was he sort of pivotal?
I don't know. Like, he was really kind of the first real boyfriend where, you know, we actually talked.
Yeah.
And he was pretty supportive for a while, or like, you know, like he, I don't know, like he just sort of believed that I would always be an artist or I could be successful.
Did you think he was talented then?
Yeah, he was very talented. He was a totally untrained, talented person. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know where he suddenly he was doing music, and it started with Oingo Boingo as a street theater.
He actually did it on the street?
Yeah, they had kind of like a marching kind of band. His older brother, and who was married to this beautiful French woman.
Yeah.
Marie, and they'd been in the Magic Circus together in Paris.
And that's where it started?
Yeah, it was kind of like they did like old jazz and St. Louis blues and all this kind of war costumes. It was more like theatrical in a circus way. It wasn't new wave.
Was it happening yet? New wave?
No, it wasn't. But
was it crazy here? Like in the in 69, you were like what, 16 or 15?
Yeah.
And it was just, and then the 70s just got all dark and weird.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 69 was a weird year.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Did you do much drugs?
I did some acid, but I didn't do like tons.
Yeah.
But I mostly like smoked pot, I guess.
Did you ever go up to San Francisco much?
Oh, yeah. I used to go up there when I was 15. There was a flight you could take for like $10, last flight. And I stayed with friends of my parents. I could go to the Fillmore, Avalon Ballroom. I saw Moby Grape, Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah, at the original Fillmore.
Yeah.
Did you like those bands?
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
So you liked all that? You liked the hippie
music? I was totally into that. You know,
yeah.
I had those records.
When you knew you were going to be an artist, or this idea set in, like, who was? Was it because of the trip to New York, or when you went to art school in Toronto? When was there a moment where you're like, "This is because it's such"? Like, I started to think about it myself. It's such an insulated, unique life.
Mm-hmm.
That has its own language and its own people, and that was one of the insecurities I had about talking to you. It was like, you know, I know a lot of artists, but I don't know, like, this is a very specific bunch that you ran with,
right?
And it wasn't really a music thing,
no.
And until you made it one, so when you were like at York University, was that where you started to sort of like make decisions around music?
Not really. It, we had this band, but it wasn't serious. We made it up for our media class.
Uh-huh.
And we were just bored, so we just did that. But I guess it gave me a taste for performing. But I still, when I moved to New York, it was really to be a visual artist. And then when I met Dan Graham, and
tell me about that
guy.
He
asked me, he's a pretty eccentric artist.
He's a sculptor?
He's a conceptual artist who now he makes a lot of pavilions that are, you know, he's interested in architecture, and they have materials like two-way glass. He's really into voyeurism, actually, and things like that.
Your relationship with him was long, right? I mean, you...
Yeah, well, I lived, he lived upstairs for me, so...
So he sort of was your guide,
kind
your
of,
portal.
Yeah, yeah.
When you got to New York. But you met him in California, right?
I met him, yeah, at CalArts at a lecture.
And your parents were kind of hipsters, weren't they?
They weren't conventional. They were academics. They had friends who were more bohemian.
Mm-hmm.
They were more into security, I guess.
Well, yeah.
You know, coming out of the Depression. And
but they were still within the college environment.
Yeah, and they were super supportive of creative endeavors and that sort of thing.
But it took him a long time to realize your brother was in trouble.
Yeah.
Because probably they thought, well, maybe he's just odd.
Yeah, and they just, from their generation, they didn't believe in psychiatry or, you know, it was like if you had a problem, you just had to deal with it yourself. And
right. Do you have any of that in you?
I mean, only in the last 3 years, you know, did I go into therapy.
So, yeah, you do.
But I also realize I go around thinking of myself as this really traditional sort of middle class grounded person. And I am a grounded person, but I don't, that's not my life really, or what I do is, I guess, more bohemian. Or,
you've always felt that?
I realize that I still carry this idea of myself, and that maybe also when, having a daughter, I wanted to almost overcompensate and have this really stable environment that was almost so square, you know, yeah. in the house.
Yeah.
In a certain way, but wasn't. But
right.
I don't know. I just, I realized, why do I think of myself like that? I'm actually not like that at all. But I have that in me, you know.
Right.
Because that's where I came from.
Did that happen really sort of, it must have just happened after you had the baby, right?
I think I always, you know, when I moved to New York, I was always like, God, I'm just so.
Conventional?
You know, middle class. I was just so fucking like.
Really?
I'm never going to be punk rock.
But you're so punk rock. I mean, I think for a whole generation of people, you're like it.
No, but
you're better than punk rock.
But my whole thing was like, it's good just to be yourself. You know, it's like, why? I'm not going to make some persona like Susie Sue or Lydia. You know, that's not who I am. You know what I mean? It's like, I'm not goth girl.
But you had to make decisions like that, and you seemed to come up with your own thing.
Yeah, just, but I think that was part of the, you know, the hardcore movement was really... just about being more, you know, like yourself in a way, you know.
So when you first get to New York, it's what, 1980 81?
Yeah, 1980.
And you're living down the Lower East Side.
Mm-hmm.
And like I moved there in 89, and it was the just starting to sort of like clean up or whatever the mm-hmm. hell that was. There was still a lot of dope around and stuff, but I imagine at that time it must have been insane, like just chaos everywhere.
Well, it was very, you know, downtown was a lot of, it was kind of deserted,
yeah,
you know, Tribeca totally, right. and Soho, you know, was dirty, and you know, the money, the city was pretty bankrupt. And
what was your plan when you got there?
I don't know, just to kind of see shows and make connections with, you know, maybe try and find a gallery, but I was pretty intimidated by.
What was your medium at that time?
My medium was more conceptual, and in fact, I started doing kind of interventions in people's apartments.
What is it? That was
like a kind of psychological interior designer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like altering something physically and then making a piece of art that sort of reflected something about the person.
Oh, give me an example.
I asked Dan if I could do something in his apartment. Okay. And
Dan Graham?
Yeah, which was a typical railroad apartment, right. Bathtub in the kitchen.
Yeah.
And so he didn't cook at all. So I got rid of his stove. Yeah. And I put this rubber Pirelli tile down on the floor that he had always admired, that was inside bank foyers.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like Italian kind of flooring.
Uh-huh.
And then I did a watercolor of Debbie Harry,
uh-huh.
from Blondie, because he was a huge fan.
Yeah.
On a piece of typewriter paper or something. Anyway, so that's what, and then I wrote about it and got it published in a magazine.
And that was the piece?
Yeah.
And you did several of those?
I did a few of them. I didn't do that many.
So the arc of it was you go into somebody's environment, you mm-hmm. sort of take or leave something of their life and
yeah.
make some alterations, yeah. and then write about it in an art magazine.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, but how do you really get a gallery with that?
You don't. It was just kind of an alternative to that.
But, yeah.
I mean, eventually, I had a show at this alternative space.
Which one?
White Columns, which coincidentally, I had a survey show there a year ago, last fall.
Oh, really?
It was in a different location.
Full circle.
Full circle, yeah.
It's interesting to me that, because I went to some of those shows when I was younger. I know what installations are, and I know the woman I'm with now does installations, but I always wondered, and there was a moment there where Dan Graham tells you not to get locked into a gallery, you know, into that arc of a painter, because there's nowhere else to go from there. That you want to create a conversation, mm-hmm. some sort of right. discourse with the culture.
Yeah.
Did that, what was your idea of art, outside of just, you know, being young and understanding mm-hmm. the context of the world you were working in, what did you want to do? What did you think the purpose of it was?
Hmm. Well, kind of, it's sort of an intellectual conversation.
Right.
With objet
mm-hmm.
or not, but I don't know, I think it's... just, you know, something that reflects something about the culture in a way, but also has a whole dialogue with kind of the history of art as an object and you know, and just all the different sides of it.
So yeah, it's completely self-referential and constant. That it's almost like it's like philosophy. It keeps building on itself.
Yeah, it's a language,
right?
Yeah,
until somebody keeps. You just got to keep blowing it up, right?
Yeah,
that's the idea. Like waiting for the new guy to blow up the art thing. But then you talk a lot about the '80s and just how it was you couldn't differentiate it between that art had sort of, for art's sake, had died, and that the business world had co-opted it.
Well, I mean, you know, I think Wall Street was booming, and well, there was a generation of artists, and they said, well, we're not doing that. You know, we're going to make it up ourselves, our own way.
Right.
And they went back to sort of object making and kind of fetishized objects. And then suddenly, like, painting and objects were like, that's what everyone was doing of the new generation. They called it picture generation.
So when you started writing about music and finding your way into music, I mean, you had to reckon with a lot of, like, you know, big sort of dude personalities where you sort of like, I know that you wrote specifically about rock guys, didn't you, for a little while?
Mm-hmm.
and somehow or another that helped you enter that world.
I don't know, maybe I was looking for a better relationship with a brother type.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I remember as a little girl looking at my dad's books, like something called Men at Work. Like, what is that?
Yeah, yeah.
And then I just wrote some article about, I don't know, I was always trying to write kind of faux intellectual things, make some ridiculous premise, and then try and prove it. And
yeah.
So
it was a joke?
One was kind of a, yeah, yeah. You know, about male bonding.
Right. And these were, but those were satires. They weren't real criticisms.
Well, it wasn't like they were real criticisms, but it was, I don't know, what's the most extreme thing I can write that's still considered intellectual or something? Or
right, right.
Maybe I'm not intellectual, but I kind of was playing around with that.
You didn't feel like you were intellectual?
So I thought I'd write about male sexuality.
As a woman.
Yeah.
Like, did that make waves? Did you get some attention for those writings?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, yeah. It was definitely the only thing I really did more publicly that before art making.
It's so funny to me that, like, you met Larry Gagosian, is that mm-hmm. how you say his last name? On the street in Westwood?
Yeah.
When you were a kid, almost?
Well, I was like 18 or 19.
And he was selling garbage prints?
Yes. And I worked for him framing hundreds of those. Hundreds.
It's just so flukish, isn't it?
I know, weird. You can't make this stuff up.
It's right. Weird. And then he turns out to be the biggest art dealer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then you work for him again?
Yeah.
But that was your inn in New York?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And, of course, he remembered you, right?
Yeah. I mean, I worked more for Anina, his partner in the non-commercial space. But, yeah. And then I eventually had a show with him. Less... spring or whenever it was.
Right, recently. What was in that show?
Yeah. It was a series of paintings using a wooden wreath as a mask,
uh-huh.
a masking device, and then spray painted.
Oh,
you know,
nice.
So that you take it off and then you have this sort of ghost image of the wreath.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I wanted to find something that was pretty suburban or like you could get at Home Depot and then kind of transform into this... more or not, maybe they do look tacky, but I had a show in this Schindler house up on top of Mulholland where I made the paintings in the basement, and I was into the idea of staging.
Mm-hmm.
It was like home,
like
house,
like
porn shows, and yeah, how like
real estate agents do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of, you know, into that.
Uh-huh. And it came out good.
Yeah, it was super fun.
So, when you first saw the No Wave bands, who was the first one you saw? When did that moment happen? Where did it happen where you're like, oh, shit, this is it?
I don't remember. It might have been at some place called Franklin Furnace or...
Mm-hmm.
I really can't remember who it was.
Oh, you don't?
It was...
Because I just missed all that. So, it was like the very idea of them was to not be identifiable as a movement or as a sound.
Well, I don't know. I don't think people really... thought about it, but there was a compilation that was put out that someone brought Brian Eno to this Artist Space event where all these bands were playing it. Yeah. He ended up kind of cherry picking certain bands to be on this record, and then it kind of got other people's noses out of joint and sort of broke up the community spirit of what little there was. I mean, and then other people, when I got to New York, pretty much most of it was over. I saw Mars, I saw DNA.
Was Suicide still around?
Suicide was still around. That was amazing. That was one of the first shows I saw.
It's pretty
wild.
It was
incredible,
right?
Yeah.
I just got into him fairly recently because I'm always late to the party. What was it about that guy?
He was just scary. You know, he'd go out into the audience and just go right up to you. And it was, it was just chilling. You know, it was so minimal, but...
he was haunting.
He was haunting.
Yeah, when I watched him, I was like, oh, shit.
I just, never seen anything like that.
And you saw it live.
Yeah.
So it was really...
Oh, yeah.
And at that time, all that stuff. So what provoked you to get started with it?
Dan had this...
Dan?
Graham had this performance piece where he would have a mirror behind him, and then... He would just look out into the audience and describe the audience, and then he would turn around and describe himself with the audience behind him and his gestures. And so he wanted to do that with an all-girl band because he was writing articles about all-girl bands and the Slits. And he asked me if I wanted to make up a band for this piece. Mm-hmm. He introduced me to this girl, Miranda, who was a bass player, and this other girl, Christine Hahn, who played drums with Glenn Branca's band at the time, The Static. So we, and I played guitar, so we wrote these songs and took lyrics. I took lyrics from women's magazines, like Cosmopolitan Girl. They had a whole text on the back, like, I'm a Cosmopolitan girl, and blah, blah, blah. So it was almost like a talking blues thing.
Right.
And, you know, another one was just ad copy about separates.
Yeah.
I don't know, just softball separates and lipstick.
Right.
And anyway, so we made some songs and we did this performance. We were supposed to, after a song, have some kind of interaction with the audience.
Yeah.
But we didn't really know exactly what he wanted us to do. And, we were also so nervous. I think Christine just got up during her turn and went to the bathroom and came back. And he was kind of like pissed, like he didn't think it was successful. But I kind of thought it was. Like people,
for you,
nobody knew what was going on.
Right.
Anyway, it was kind of, I think just making people, taking him out of a conventional audience performer situation was always sort of interesting. And I think that's what people were also drawn to about Kurt, because like he just took it way far, you know,
right,
as far
as
like
and same with Iggy.
Yes, of course. Iggy, he was definitely amazing.
So that's what you felt that first time. It's interesting that, you know, it was a manufactured sort of event by this dude.
Yeah, right, right.
Who just had this
big
idea.
Yeah, and then we didn't do what, you know, it was kind of manipulative. We didn't do, you know, what we're
Was he a Lecce guy?
No,
that's good. He just had some big ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think he had he had some big ideas, but no, I mean, you know, it was kind of interesting what he was trying to do. I think he was trying to activate a woman's, you know, instead of a woman traditionally being in a passive position where people project stuff onto them and. That we would be active in some way, and although we were already playing, I don't know. But something about crossing back into that barrier, or you know,
right? Yeah.
I think it's like really similar to maybe being a stand-up comic in a certain way, or stand-up.
Yeah, it's a very weird thing, because I know in the book there was a little piece about Chappelle and that event. It's very the space that you can choose to occupy, you know, as an artist of any kind. It really is, it's up to you.
Right.
And you can sit in it in whatever discomfort you want. for however long you want to do it. Sometimes I resent the audience. Sometimes I resent that they're expecting something from me. Sometimes, you know, I feel like, oh, we're all great. We're all one mind. And then other times you want to make them pay for something.
Yeah.
Do you have those feelings?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think it's similar to, you know, yeah.
But that's just me. Some guys just go tell jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an easy way to do things.
Right, right.
But it's not your way, right? It's not my way. Yeah. I mean, there seems to be an almost active resentment of the easy way to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have that still?
A little bit. I mean, I like doing this improv duo I have with Bill Nace. You know, it's just two guitars and vocals, and it's really fun. But it's scary because we go out and we don't really have anything planned.
Right.
You know, we make it up every night, and yet we know how each other plays, and so it seems like a band.
Where do you do that at?
Well, we just did three shows here, one at the Getty, one at the Echo, and one in Orange County.
Oh, yeah?
We went to Australia. We were in a couple festivals.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. I mean, we've done touring in Europe, and we put a record out last fall in Matador.
Okay.
That was really surprisingly well received.
What's it called?
It's called Coming Apart.
Good.
We play with film behind us in slow motion.
Right.
It's so slow that it kind of implies there's a narrative of some kind, but you don't really, it doesn't ever evolve into anything.
When you started playing with the band, with the original Sonic Youth, well, you met Thurston was in another band?
Yeah, he was in a band called The Coachmen.
Yeah.
That my friend Miranda took me to see.
Were they a good band?
They're okay. They had the jangly guitar thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Kind of more new wave-ish, sort of.
Were you anti-new
RISD
wave?
RISD Rock.
Yeah, yeah.
RISD Rock.
Oh, is that what they called it? RISD Rock?
Yeah.
Is that what
they were
Talking
from RISD.
Heads?
Yeah.
Yeah, that school?
Yeah.
Did you like any of those guys? Did you like Verlaine or any of them?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Burn, yeah. Not so much?
Early Talking Heads, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So were they around? They were just...
No, they weren't. I mean, they were famous by then. You know,
by the time you got there?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I mean, Thurston saw all those bands in the late 70s. He came from Connecticut.
He's a Connecticut kid.
Yeah.
He's going to take the train into the city or whatever. Mm-hmm. So you meet him at that show.
Yeah. And that was the last show of his band, actually.
That you saw?
That was their last show. It was just ending, and it wasn't me.
Yeah, you had nothing to do.
And then he was playing with this girl, Miranda. I mean, Anda Marinus, who was Vito Acconci's girlfriend at the time. So I started playing with them.
Yeah.
And after Thurston and I sort of got together, and she was a keyboard player, and we had a series of different drummers, and changed our names, and finally arrived at this name, Sonic Youth, and it was kind of like then we sort of realized we didn't really want to play with a keyboard player anymore, and we just sort of parted ways from her and met Lee.
Right.
You know, we knew Lee, he was around, and Thurston put on this festival at White Columns, the Noise Fest, because there was nowhere to play for bands, so it became like a 10-day long, bands just kept asking to play.
Specific kinds of bands or any bands?
It was really kind of a wide range, you know. It was, I mean, people downtown, it wasn't...
So punk was over, kind of.
Yeah, punk was definitely over.
And CBGB's was kind of starting to be over.
Well, CB's was still going, but Hurrah's had closed, and I think Tier 3 had closed.
Uh-huh. I interviewed Thurston once, and it was embarrassing. It was when I hosted an evening show here, and we were trying to talk about noise bands, but I didn't know any noise bands. I knew none.
Well, it was weird. I mean, that was a term, actually, that was a derogatory term at that time. Like the owner of Hurrah said, well, these bands just sound like noise.
Right.
So no one really liked that term. So it just, we sort of took it as this thing, but it was definitely derogatory.
So it wasn't a real movement.
Not really. You know, there was like John Zorn and the improv thing going on.
Where were they at that?
But there weren't any.
Knitting Factory guys?
Like it was pre-Knitting Factory.
Zorn's out there, man. That's pretty wild shit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, he comes out of new music composition and jazz.
But wasn't that like kind of heady?
Yeah, but we weren't really, like at that time, there was no real clear movement. There was like the Swans and us and Live Skull and... there just didn't feel like we didn't fit in.
Right, with anybody.
Yeah, and there was like the Hoboken pop scene with the individuals and mm-hmm. the bongos, and that they were like the ones that were popular. And
it's kind of this middle zone.
Yeah.
Now, you guys kind of owned it. But who did you tour with first?
Well, we just toured with ourselves. I mean, we brought along Dinosaur Jr. when they were on one tour. They were touring in a station wagon. Mm-hmm. They were really young.
And they opened for you?
Yeah.
So they so the tours where you open for larger acts didn't happen until later.
No, we didn't. That was nothing we were interested in at all.
At the
like,
beginning.
We're not interested. Yeah. Well, we were never interested in it, except we were happy to do it when Neil asked us to do it.
When Neil Young did, yeah.
But we weren't, you know, we were never really into that.
What were you into? What was the idea?
It was really baby steps, you know,
like yeah.
getting a gig at CBGB's.
Right.
Then making a record, then going on tour.
And how'd you evolve the sound? I mean, you guys would just sit there and work it out because there's, you know, the mm-hmm. dissonant sound and like the mm-hmm. guitar is tuned weird. Uh-huh. And then, you know, there's some droning going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, how did you know when you clicked it, when it was happening?
Did you just sit there for,
yeah?
You know, I don't, well, we liked things that were contrasted, like a melody line, and then dynamics, you know,
right.
things that got loud, things mm-hmm. that got soft. And I don't know, it was like we just kind of really played it, kind of formed it organically as the arrangements.
Because it's interesting, like it's a completely definable sound that you guys repeated, mm-hmm. you know, that you have, like Sonic Youth sounds like Sonic Youth and mm-hmm. no one really sounds like you. So, you know, it must have felt, there must have been a groove achieved that kept kind of growing. You knew when you hit it, right?
Yeah, I guess so, yeah.
Yeah. What was that Neil Young tour? When was that? What album had come
out?
That
was, that must have been after Goo, our first major label debut.
It's wild to me that real bands that, you know, people that are in it for the long haul mm-hmm. and have a defined sound, mm-hmm. you can hear it in the earliest music. Do you ever mm-hmm. listen to that stuff?
Sometimes, you know, it's weird. Sometimes I'll walk into a store or someplace and I'll hear something. I'll go, God, that sounds so familiar. And I go, shit.
I put the fucking MC5 on when Wayne Kramer came over. Like, he was walking up the driveway and they've only got 3 records out.
Oh, man.
And he's playing and I'm like, you recognize that? He's like, I don't. He did not know. And he walked in, he didn't know.
That's funny. I don't know. Like, I definitely can hear a tuning. You know, I can tell right. it's us because of the...
Yeah, it's a specific dissonance, right?
Yeah, it's just some, you know, not that other people don't use different tunings in their guitars, but something about the tone and, yeah.
And when you... Well, I mean, I know that obviously what's happened with you and Thurston has happened, but when it was good... Did you guys loved playing, right? I mean, and Lee, too. Like, all that drummer, too.
Steve.
It's crazy.
Yeah. He's a great drummer.
He's a great drummer.
Yeah.
And you all got along for the most part?
For the most part. You know, I mean, there's always little band dynamics. But, you know, the older we got, I think I thought we were learning how to get along better.
Yeah. Did you have any
idea? It's really hard when you're a democracy and then you're all trying to mix a record. You know, I think when we found people that we all felt good working with, that was much better, you know.
You're very candid about the dissolving of the relationship in mm-hmm. the book. And I wrote a book about my divorce, and it's very cathartic to do that. And it feels good. But when you write that stuff, when you talk about the specifics of it, mm-hmm. do you do it to purge yourself or to help others, or it's just part of your story?
To help others. I think, well, for me, it's partly, I can't think unless I'm writing, or mm-hmm. I can't figure out how I'm feeling about something. And when something like that happens to you, that's so kind of spins you off, and you start looking back at your whole life, like, how did I get to where I am? And I couldn't really... figure out where I am now, unless I did. And, you know, I tried to be as minimal about it as I could.
When I went through it, and even talking about, you were very diplomatic about your parents and about, mm-hmm. but you didn't really completely throw anybody under the bus. And it's hard not to. I mean, when I wrote my book, my father went right under the bus.
Yeah. I'm older than you, more mature.
Is that it? Is that what? He's still around, and I caught a lot of shit about it. I don't know how my ex feels about it, but I tried to be.
Yeah,
it's very hard because.
Well, I'm sure that some people will be bummed out about my book, you know. But
yeah, I don't know. Here's what this thing you said. I wonder whether you can truly love or be loved back by someone who hides who they are. It's made me question my whole life and all my other relationships.
Yeah.
That kind of blew my mind. I highlighted it. Look at that shit. Shit is highlighted, Kim. The thing like that, that kind of spun me out because then I'm thinking about art and about what you're really digging it for. And is it some sort of something that has to happen in the present that's completely different and mind-blowing? Or is it some kind of truth you're looking for? And then when you come up with something like that.
Isn't that what it does when you lose your identity? Like your identity is so wrapped up with another person, and that person is also part of your work and your income and your everything.
Yeah, well, that's a and unique then, situation.
So it just, like, obviously, no matter what someone does, it is two people who create a situation. So, you know, I just sort of wanted to examine myself and see how I contributed or didn't or
Right. And then you were wary to use words like codependent and narcissist.
Well, I don't know. They seem so therapy talk, but. I don't know. You know, like it's like someone can be a narcissist or have, you know, we're all somewhere on the spectrum of that. And, but then there is like some like narcissist disorder or.
Right. There's a difference between having narcissistic.
Or like a toxic borderline.
Ooh, scary stuff. That is.
So, but you know, beyond that, like, it's true, you really can't help who you fall in love with if you believe you're in love or, you know, and people do change, and whether they change because they've repressed a big part of who they are or, and I have to say, I'm sure I was stuck in the whole thing too. My marriage, you know, I was not, it's kind of brought me, made me free. And allowed me to basically get back to where I feel like what I should be doing, you know, making art and things that are really inherent and authentic
to you,
primary to who I am, and that I actually like put that on the back burner is kind of upsetting to me.
Right. You know? In retrospect.
Yeah, in retrospect.
Well, I guess it, like, I don't know what drives a band, but I guess the compulsion to just keep working is a lot of it, right?
Sure. And it's kind of like a machine. It just, like, keeps going, you know?
Yeah. And how, and he was, like, I don't know, he's a little older than me. I mean, it's so weird, I guess, and I can understand what you were saying before about how, you know, feeling like middle class or conventional is, like, it's not an unusual tale.
Right.
You know?
For sure.
It's right. It's so. It's just.
Yeah, it's nothing special. I mean, it happens to so many people.
Right. It's how people fuck up.
Yeah.
God damn it. So.
Yeah, and I've known, you know, since then I've met, you know, several couples or friends whose marriages have completely fallen apart, and you know, and then they're reading my book and they're just like relating to it, and it's strange.
Well, it's such, and also I think that the idea of how technology leaves this, like, all this, like, that feeling that you had where it was almost like he was just dying to be caught.
Right.
Because I know that when my first marriage broke up and I was the bad guy, you know, it just, you're a coward. And then you get caught.
Right. And then you're kind of relieved in a way or something.
Well, yeah, something. But then you kind of want your cake and you want to eat it too. And you want to, you want to be a child. And
yeah, you want everything to be okay. You don't want to be looked at as a bad person.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
Like the heartbreak of it is just like, I definitely related to it.
Yeah.
And do you think outside of this writing, as you sort of, you know, take... re-own yourself or whatever. Do you feel like some of this pain is informing, other than the performance I saw on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which it was devastating to me. Do you feel that you're going to purge yourself even more with this stuff?
I don't know. I mean, right now I feel okay.
Oh, yeah? Good. Good.
That's but, good. You know, there's obviously, I've been so busy. So, you know, it's times when you're not busy that you can feel sad or. Ugh. But I've had so many amazing things happen to me since then. And, you know, so many great things going on. And I don't know.
It's pretty amazing to watch. Like when I watched some of this stuff, because I was rewatching things of you guys playing and you know, you covering like Iggy songs, and then like just these moments where you guys are all, there's something you wrote in the book about just dodging guitars, that y'all, you were in it, but then on the periphery, you just
right.
see guitars coming at you.
Yeah.
Another thing that you talked about that I found compelling and I could relate to is this perpetual sense of not doing enough, of insecurity, of maybe feeling like a fraud. Of some kind artistically, do you still get that?
Well, I'm sure some people feel like I should just play music and not make art or something. And some people think I should play conventional songs, or I don't know, you know, people get weird ideas about you.
Could you ever play conventional songs?
No. I mean, this writing this book's probably the most conventional thing I've ever done.
So. And it's very straightforward.
Yeah.
Because I was reading some of your essays, because I got hold of another book of the essays.
Oh, yeah.
And it's different. Like, this book is very kind of like close to the bone.
Yeah. I mean, parts of it were really boring to write. Jesus. Just like having the nuts and bolts of talking about things that you feel like you've talked about in interviews, or just to have can I just Wikipedia what the raincoats sound like?
Right.
Or something.
Yeah. Just put that in scope. You know, Google.
Yeah. But, you know, I liked writing about L.A. and early New York, and, you know, certain things were fun to write about.
Yeah, and your daughter, too. I mean, like, that bit where you watch her for the first time, that got me choked up. I just cry.
Yeah.
How's she doing?
She's good. She goes to the Chicago Art Institute.
Wow.
Third year student, and has a great boyfriend.
Cool.
She's known since high school, but they weren't together then, but...
Yeah, and it worked out?
Yeah, he's a really good musician, actually.
And she's going to go the music route?
No, she's an artist.
Oh, yeah?
Painter, yeah.
Do you feel ecstatic about that?
Oh, yeah, I'm thrilled. I mean, I love her. She's so, like, one of, you know, my favorite people to hang out with. She's so cool.
That's so sweet. Yeah. Well, look, I hope I did justice to our conversation.
Yeah, I mean, it's Valentine's Day. I thought maybe
what
we could trade dating experiences.
Okay, well, let's see.
Do you have any advice for me, as somebody who's like,
I'm dating this painter now, which is all new thing because she's like completely consumed, like artists are in her art, and I'm not used to that type of detachment. I'm a little needy. I'm not a good dater.
Yeah.
I don't really know how to do it.
Yeah.
I was married twice, and like I don't know that, and certainly you've been in a certain type of limelight long enough to where it becomes very difficult to date when you're a public person.
Right.
And people know you.
Yeah.
So you have to almost look for these people that are going to pretend like they've never heard of you before, or else date in your pool.
Yeah.
I don't know. It depends what you want. All I know is that I've gotten very cynical. Mm-hmm. About relationships and about love and about, you know, like I'm at this age, well, I'm 51, where I'm like, I don't have to do anything I don't want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't have to put up with anyone's shit.
Yeah.
So that's sort of like...
That's a good attitude.
that's sort of where I'm kind of at. It's like, you know, I don't, you know, nah.
Yeah.
You got a lot of, you know, I got my own baggage. I get that. But you're like, mm-hmm. like, why not just have fun if that's possible?
Right.
What are we looking for at this point?
Exactly. Like, you're not looking for someone to start a whole life with.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
You know, what are you experiencing?
I don't know. Well, I was actually out with a friend who, this really good writer, and she, I'm going to kind of, not steal her idea, but just, she was talking about relationships and how she did a lot of dating when she moved out here and before she met her husband. And she said, well, it seems like there are two kinds of people or relationships. Like the first kind where, you know, they they want to zip you up in a suit with them.
Yeah.
Together and completely intermesh your lives.
Right.
Together.
Yeah.
Super meshed.
Right.
And the other kind where you kind of go in and out of each other's
right
lives and you have space.
Right.
And I would definitely be more of the second leaning.
Sure.
You know, like I need a lot of space.
Yeah, mentally, that sounds very good to me. But emotionally, I don't know.
Yeah.
Like, you know, whatever's gurgling up in there in terms of needs or how that's going to use me as a puppet. I'm not always quite clear. That's the big challenge.
Are you a Virgo?
Libra.
Huh.
Yeah. Almost a Virgo. You think that has a bearing on this?
Possibly.
Well, because like when you were talking about that.
Maybe your rising sign's Virgo.
Maybe. I don't know. I got to look it up.
Yeah.
I've had charts done, but it gets a little overwhelming. But like when you talked about projecting a fantasy on people, like that whole thing. Like, you know, there's some definitely, like, you're definitely, you know, your wisdom's coming through. It's good. Like that whole idea of like, you're making somebody up to fit, you know, what you need.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's only a matter of time before they disappoint you.
Right.
That's a fucking problem.
Yeah, that's a problem.
Yeah, I've been talking about this book.
Yeah, like, do you meet people who are like, you don't know why they like you? Like, do they like you because...
No idea.
I mean, it's all part of who you are anyway, what you do.
Right.
Whether it's...
Right.
You know, you're... So, of course they're going to like you because of what you do also. That's like, it's not like...
It's kind of weird. You kind of doubt it, though.
And then sometimes. You, I guess, feel like once they get to know you that maybe... I'm saying you, but I mean, you know.
You, yeah.
The universal you.
Right.
That they won't like you or something.
Or that, why would they? That's it.
So do you think love's insane?
I don't, it's like there's like, I don't know, like I've been taught over time and from, you know, bad experiences that, you know, what I experience as, you know, what does love really mean to any one person? You know, there's this intensity that happens and there, like, as you get older, you can't deny the craziness of the relationships. Mm-hmm. And then I think that what's happened to me is that you just live with this heartbreak. It doesn't disappear. It just sort of fades in intensity. And it just, it becomes like this weird thing that just kind of percolates there. And I guess you can fall in love again. But after a certain point, like how much drama, how much bullshit you want to.
It's true.
But then all of a sudden you find yourself in crazy land.
Yeah.
But like, it's good that you have a child that's growing up nicely and you have that responsibility. I don't have any of that. I'm still a fucking idiot.
Yeah. I mean, she's... you know, in college now, and
but you did that.
Yeah, but I feel a little unsprung. Like,
what now?
Now I feel like a teenager or something.
Well, are you meeting good people? Do you have good people to hang out with?
Yeah.
And you're dating cool people.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not. I don't know. I don't know what my dating status is
right
now. But
are you with people like around our age or
mostly younger?
Oh,
I don't
yeah?
meet anyone my age.
Yeah?
Never.
Huh. Weird.
Yeah.
Might not be good. Go with younger. Why not?
Yeah. You think? That's all I meet.
Younger's good. I'm glad you're doing that. It's nice to hear. Because men always get sort of a, you know, bad rap for that.
Yeah. I understand now why they do it.
Yeah. Good for you. Oh, you also mentioned Danny Goldberg, who I had a miserable experience with. Is he still in your life? Not a good
time.
No,
I don't know what Danny... does he think he's a manager now or something?
I don't know. All he knows is he came into Air America when I was a morning guy there and just fired me.
Oh.
And he was like this weird, kind of like confused, medicated person wandering around the halls.
Huh. How long ago was that?
They brought him in as CEO for reasons that I don't know. That was in 2005, maybe? Yeah, but he was like... He was definitely one of the villains in the Marc Maron narrative. Hmm. But, so, what are you going to do? You going to do art? You going to do music?
Yeah, I'm probably going to, you know, do art, mostly art, but also do music.
Do you think you'll ever forgive that man?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I hope so someday.
Hard, right?
But,
it's, you know, it's actually good that, you know, your daughter's all grown up and you don't have to deal with that. Thing of like Are you picking a rapper?
For sure. Yeah. That.
Well, you seem good.
That's tough.
Oh, yeah. You seem good to me.
Thanks.
It's great talking to you, and I appreciate you coming.
I'm so happy to be here.
Good.
I'm a huge fan of your show.
Thank you. And thank you for this book. I liked it. I'm almost done.
Great.
And now I've listened to all the Sonic Youth records.
What's your favorite Sonic Youth record?
Well, it's weird because I hadn't heard the first one that I ever...
Did you ever even... I didn't even know you listened to Sonic Youth.
Yeah, well, there's like... It's weird when I talk to musicians.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can like somebody, but not listen to everything.
Yeah, of course.
Do you know how can you do that?
Yeah.
But Daydream Nation, Goo, and Dirty were like, I remember when Goo came out, I bought a cassette tape.
Mm-hmm.
So I had it
That's
on.
Cool.
Right. I had it on cassette, and I remember it, and I listened to it a lot. And then, like, you know, things happen.
Mm-hmm.
So those three I really was familiar with, but then, like, I never went all the way back.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that, and I went a little bit forward. And then I got, you know, it, every time I talk to a musician, I get to like, and then like, I don't know, never knew who Glenn Branca was.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's plenty of people who are listening. Like, of course you didn't, asshole. Like, how could you not know like those people? But it was great to listen to it all again and to talk to you. I was nervous, but I think it went good.
I was afraid that you were going to make me cry.
Come on. Why do people say that?
I don't know.
I
cry easily if I'm just in a certain mood or something.
Well, you made me cry this morning. You made me cry this morning. I just want you to feel like did I feel like an idiot?
No.
All right. Thanks for talking, Kim.
Sure.
That's it. That's the show. I enjoyed talking to Kim Gordon. I enjoyed meeting her. And she was right here in my house. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF pod needs. And remember, theme music is by John Montagna. Other music on today's episode was by DJ Copley. Check the Marination dates, people. Check those dates because we added shows in Boston, Toronto. We added a show in Asheville. Philadelphia is pretty close to selling out. Houston is sold out. You can go to WTFpod.com/calendar and see when I'm coming. I'm a little worn out. Still getting over a cold. I don't know what these... I can't use that box anymore because it causes trouble. What box can I use? What does that one do? Lives!